Good morning, everybody on the
phone. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Office of the Seniors Advocate Conference Call. I would like to introduce Isabel McKenzie. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome. It's Isabel McKenzie speaking, and my apologies. I think we're a minute late starting the call, and I'm going to offer further apologies. We are having some technical difficulties with our uploading onto our website, and I have some new information for people to access the PowerPoint presentation and the report itself. I will read these instructions out and give everybody a couple of minutes to get online. So the first thing is for people to go to the Office of Seniors Advocate website at www.seniorsadvocatebc.ca. Again, that's seniorsadvocatebc.ca. Once you get to that website, go to the icon. It's in about the middle of the page on the second row, labeled Updates OSA Presentations. And you will see a line there called Future Events. Click on the Future Events icon under Updates OSA Presentation. Once you click on that, you will see a line for August 30th event. Click on that. And text will come up on your screen. Scroll to the bottom where it says to see the report, PowerPoint, and presentation. You'll click on that, and up will come today's presentation. I'm going to repeat these instructions. Go to the Seniors Advocate website, seniorsadvocatebc.ca. Go to the section entitled Updates/OSA Presentation. It's a box in the middle of the page. You will see in that box a line called Future Events. Click on the Future Events line within the Updates OSA Presentation box. When you do that, you will see a link for the August 30th event. Click on that. And you will see at the bottom of that page a link that says to see the report presentation, click here. Click there and up will come the presentation for today. Okay, hopefully everybody has the presentation and a copy of the report, and we will get the technical difficulties ironed out, and certainly we will get our report up on the website today as soon as possible. And just a reminder that this this presentation will also be posted up on the website. So I'm going to be using PowerPoint slides as part of my presentation. Some of you have been through these presentations before and you know the drill. I'm going to say next slide and you can advance to the next slide. I can't stop you from advancing ahead of my instructions, but I would encourage you not to. And then my presentation is going to be about 30 minutes or so, after which I'm going to open the floor for questions. I'm aware that there will be some media deadlines. There's some media here in the room, Victoria. And I will take media questions first, and then questions from anybody else. Just a reminder that if you have a question, you can queue to ask a question at any time during my presentation by pressing the numbers 0 and 1 on your telephone, and the moderator will queue you up for the question. And you can withdraw your question at any time by pressing the number sign on your phone. We'll be asked to provide your name and whether or not you're from India. And the phone agent on the line will manage the questions. And just as I said before, this conference is being recorded and the recording will be uploaded on my office's website shortly after the presentation and as soon as we get some of these technicalities, technical issues out of the way. So, caregivers in distress, a growing problem, is the title of our latest report and presentation today, and I will ask you to advance to the next slide, which is labeled caregivers. So just in terms of context, a little bit about why we have chosen this topic and why we are updating our 2015 report. It is estimated that there are approximately 1 million unpaid caregivers in the province of BC. So to put it in context, that's almost 1 in 4 British Columbians are a caregiver. They could be a caregiver to a mom, a dad, a spouse, an adult child. And the caregiving activities they engage in can range dramatically. It can be as simple as giving a ride to the grocery store or, in fact, getting the groceries once a week. It could be part of a team of caregivers. You're one of two or three siblings helping mom or dad. Or it can be you are the only caregiver in the home 24 hours a day with the person needing the care, and you're doing everything for them, from bathing to helping them to the toilet to feeding them to dressing them. You can see that it's a wide spectrum. We have estimated that replacing the care provided by unpaid caregivers or informal caregivers or family caregivers, and I'm going to use those terms interchangeably, would cost the province of BC approximately $3.5 billion. And I'm going to repeat that number. Replacing the care provided by family caregivers in this province would cost approximately $3.5 billion. And so I think that tells us that we have an interest in ensuring that family caregivers are supported and able to continue in the work they do. Because if they aren't, and if they can no longer continue their caregiving duties, there will be a huge transfer of liability from family caregivers to provincial taxpayers. And so it does tell us that we do need to pay attention. This report focuses on the caregiver distress for those providing what we call informal care, unpaid care, to the clients receiving publicly subsidized home support services in BC. And you may ask why we have focused on this subset. Two reasons. Number one, we can get robust, comparable assessment data on the people being cared for and the people caring for them. And that this group of folks are the most vulnerable seniors in our community, and without these caregivers would likely need to move into a supported living environment, either in assisted living or in complex care. I want to acknowledge that this does not address all of the caregivers. We know there's about 115,000 BC seniors out there who aren't under our home support program, who, by our diagnostic code, we know have as significant a need as the ones under our home support program. But we're not able to reliably gather some data. So I want to emphasize that this is a problem that speaks to a wider need than just what I'm going to be talking about today. So, caregivers in distress, a growing problem, and we had hoped that when we did this report we could entitle it a diminishing problem, but unfortunately we cannot. This is an update to a report we issued in 2015 called Caregivers in Distress, More Respite Needed. And our 2015 report, 2 years ago, we found that BC had one of the highest levels of caregiver distress in the country. We're right up there with Ontario. Everybody else is quite far behind us, so we have to take a look at some of the factors that are causing us to have this extraordinarily high level of distress. We made recommendations in that report for how we could help to ameliorate some of the issues for caregivers. We advocated increasing levels of adult day programs, respite beds, and home support hours, amongst other things. And so now it's 2 years later. We've had time to implement them. We've had time for these recommendations to take effect and to measure their efficacy. And so the question, of course, is how are you doing? And the answer, unfortunately, is not very well. So compared to 2 years ago, our rate of caregiver distress has increased by 7%. Our hours per day of home support for people 65 and over has decreased by 5%. Our hours of home support for people 85 and over has decreased by 7%. So we might have thought that you could see a decrease in younger age because we're just delaying the age at which we need help, but we should then be seeing the increase in the higher age, and we're seeing, in fact, a further decrease in our older seniors in terms of home support. Adult day programs, one of the key supports providing respite. Our number of clients provincially are down by 5% in the last 2 years, and the number of days offered to those clients is down by 2%. So arguably, though getting adult day program may be getting a little bit more, but fewer people are getting it. Our respite clients, and these are people who would go to a respite bed for a week or 2 weeks or a month, actually has increased by 5%. The number of clients has increased by 5%, but the average length of stay in that respite bed has decreased in 4 out of 5 health authorities. So when you add all of this up, what you see is the burden is shifting from the public system to the private caregiver, to the family caregiver. And that is why we are seeing an increase in the distress level. There are 30,363 clients receiving long-term home support in a given year in this province. And I think it's interesting to look at how have they changed over the last 2 years. And what we see right across the board is that the degree of complexity, frailty is increasing against a backdrop of decreasing home support and decreasing adult day programs. The average age, 82.3, that's up 2% from 2 years ago. The 20% have what we call an activities of daily living, ADL score of 3+. It ranges from 0 to 6. Higher number indicates greater need. That's a 7% increase in the last 2 years. Moderate to severe cognitive impairment. So there's mild to moderate and there's moderate to severe. 21% have moderate to severe cognitive impairment, and that's a 7% increase over the last 2 years. MAPLE 4+, so a MAPLE score is an algorithm that we use taking all of the assessment data that we have as a predictor for placement in residential care. It's a scale of 1 to 5. Generally, MAPLE 4 and MAPLE 5 are considered appropriate for placement in a care facility. 52% of our home support clients are MAPLE 4 and 5, which means that 52% of our home support clients, this is the group we're studying, actually meet the criteria for placement in either an assisted living or a licensed care facility. That's an increase of 4% over 2 years ago. Dementia. 32% of our home support population have a diagnosis of dementia. That's an increase of 4% over the past 2 years. Aggressive behaviors, 12% demonstrate aggressive behaviors, and that's a 7% increase over the last 2 years. That's one of the more difficult things that family members find to manage, is loved ones who demonstrate aggressive behaviors, and it's actually a big trigger for placement in residential care. Difficulty with medication management, is 72% of our home support clients have difficulty with medication management, and that's an increase of 4% over the last 2 years. So it's very clear that just in the last 2 years, the frailty, the complexity of the people being cared for on our home support program has increased. So who's providing the care to these home support clients? Obviously, they have formal care through home support or they would be on this roster. But 91% of the primary caregivers that are assisting them, and I should go back and say that 96% have a caregiver in their family, 91% of the primary caregivers were family members. So that's why when we use the term unpaid or informal, we talk about family caregivers. Interestingly, 58% of adult children. So when we look at the generational burden of family caregivers, we find that the majority of the caregiving burden is actually on the backs of the adult children, who are, some of them, to be fair, are seniors themselves, but many are also trying to work and raise them. 21% of the primary caregivers are spouses, and 12% were others. On average, 20 hours a week of informal care. When they co-reside, it's 32 hours a week. And when they don't co-reside, it's 11 hours. I'm going to give, there's lots of data about who's co-residing and how that is a predictor of burden. So how are the caregivers coping? Not that well. 31% of clients had a primary caregiver in distress. Now, I have to also say, when you look at this data, at these data, what also strikes you is 69% are not reporting distress when you look at who they're caring for. And what that speaks to is the love and devotion that there is amongst the overwhelming majority of our family caregivers, and speaks to how the least we can do is provide a little more help. So as I said previously, it's a 7% increase over what we found in 2015. That's in terms of the percentage, but the absolute numbers are also a story. So the absolute number of caregivers in distress increased by 1,000 in the last 2 years, which is a 14% increase in the actual number of distressed caregivers in the last 2 years. What increases the risk of distress? So we want to know, what are the characteristics of the client, what are the characteristics of the caregiver that can predict that they will experience distress, so we can go in and try to target the interventions that will best help. So mild cognitive impairment doubles the risk of caregiver distress. Moderate to severe triples the risk of distress. And so any of us who have worked with seniors know there's the profile of the senior who has very limited physical needs, very physically robust, but they are severely cognitively impaired. They cannot manage their independent activities of daily living. They cannot be left alone. They present visually as a fit person, more or less. But the strain and stress on the family members is that they need constant attention and constant monitoring. We also know that there are people with severe cognitive impairment who have severe physical impairments as well. Potential or actual problem with depression over double the risk. And it's an interesting thing. Living with a person with depression is extremely stressful, is what the data tell us. Even more stressful than just a physical disability. Dementia, 25% increase in the risk of distress with a diagnosis of dementia, because you can have a diagnosis of dementia and only have very, very mild cognitive impairment at the time. The presence of any behavioral and psychological symptoms of dementia, however, there's a 75% increase in the risk of distress. And those of us who have worked with this population know who we're talking about. The folks who you can't predict when there's going to be an outburst. The outburst can turn violent. It can be physically challenging depending on the size of the person who's experiencing the agitation. And it ratchets up the distress level exponentially. Caregiver factors. So when you're the spouse, 80% increased risk of distress. Co-residing, when you're the co-residing caregiver and you're not the spouse, so you'll be the adult child, 40% increased risk. And the higher levels of informal care hours is a mild risk, but it does increase the risk. What are the effects of co-residing on distress? When it's a spouse, it's the most stressful, 48%. Adult child, it's 38%. When they're non-residing, the highest levels are with the adult child. When it's another relative and not the adult child, it's slightly less at 22%. Friend or neighbor, 15%. And that, I think, is partly to acknowledge the effect of there's the physical toll that caregiving gives. There's a psychological toll that affects people differently, and adult children have different reactions and different stresses to seeing the increasing frailty and dependence of their parents. So on that note, what are some potential tensions? Now, an interesting thing is, in the assessment, we ask clients and their caregivers if they feel they would be better off living somewhere else. And we use this as a bit of a proxy for people who are living at home on home supports about, do you want to move into assisted living or into residential care? Overall, about 20% of our home support clients actually feel they would be better off living somewhere else, compared to 29% from their caregivers. So already you're seeing a bit of a tension point when 20% want to stay at home, but almost 30% or a third of their caregivers actually want them somewhere else. Now that tension is not evenly distributed. So when we look at the lowest care needs clients, we find out that there's a differential. It's almost equal. About 18% of clients want to be somewhere else, about 20% of their caregivers. But when we look at the higher risk of, so what we call the Maple 4s and 5s, not very many more clients. It goes up to 23% of the clients want to be somewhere else, but 39% of the caregivers want them somewhere else. That creates a tension that we have to talk about and that I think is exacerbating the distress, because anybody who's ever been in the living room with the family with the discussion, the heart-wrenching discussions, when mom or dad wants to stay at home and the children want mom or dad to go to the facility because the burden of caregiving has taken over the life of the adult child. That is a tension we need to recognize and to talk more about, I think, because it is certainly a factor in caregiver distress. Now, interestingly enough, we looked at the different ways we deliver home support, and we found that the choices for supports for independent living, CECL, home support clients who were in receipt of CECL had a 50% lower risk of caregiver distress. It's very significant. We cannot ignore this. CECL is the program that effectively gives client direct funding. So rather than have the health authority home support program say, we're going to be here at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock in the morning, you're going to get your hour of care, you get your set of different workers. We give you, the family, the client, the money to hire who you want, when you want to do the care the way you want it to be done. And we see that even though the clients on the CECL program have higher levels of complexity relative to the other home support clients, the distress level is significantly lower. And we're going to talk about this more in our home support report that's going to come out later this year. But it was very significant. So how can we help? So in BC, we have three provincial programs that we deliver that can give targeted support for respite: home support, adult day programs, and respite beds. And so we looked 2 years ago, and we look again 2 years later at the utilization of those. And given that we're seeing an increased complexity of clients and an increase in distress, we should see significant increases in the uptake of these support programs, right? And in fact, what we see is the opposite. So the number of home support clients accessing the adult day program went down by 5%, and the number of days delivered to these clients went down by 2%. That is moving in exactly the opposite direction of where we should be moving, given the other data that we're seeing. The average hours of home support per day went down by 5% for clients 65 and older, and by 7% for 85 and older. Again, that would be acceptable if we were seeing decreases in complexity. We're not. We're seeing increases in complexity. We should be seeing increases in the intensity of home support. There are 60% of the clients on home support get an hour a day or less, and yet 52% of them would meet the threshold for placement in assisted living or residential care. So we really are moving in the wrong direction on that. Now, where we have made a bit of progress is that our residential care respite clients increased by 5%. We decreased the average length of stay in 4 out of 5 health authorities, so we increased the number of people who could access it. And so that is moving a little bit in the right direction. But overall, there's still less than, I think, 11% of people accessing respite. So, we're moving in the right direction, but we certainly haven't reached where we need to be. Additional caregiver support. So beyond increasing service levels of home support, adult day program, respite bed, What other things can we do to support caregivers? And we briefly touch on this in our report. And we looked at the evidence that said identifying caregivers as early as you can is important, and that individuals, particularly the spouses and to some extent the adult children, don't identify what they're doing as caregiving, and so they don't identify themselves as caregivers. And so they don't see driving mom to the doctor as a caregiving duty. But that's how it starts. And then it incrementally grows now it's I pop in every day to check on how she's doing. Now I pop in twice a day. Now I've got her moving. It slowly grows incrementally. And what we know is if we can identify you as a caregiver way, 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 way back when you're starting those drives to the doctor's appointment, we can link you up to some resources fairly early, and that will make a difference. And so we want to link caregivers with community support earlier. We do have the Family Caregivers Association of BC, so we have a provincial network that can do it, and we've made some, I'll talk about the recommendation on that. And to provide some training and education for caregivers. One of the things that strikes you when you look at the data about the clients and when you look at the limited public supports they get is that you realize the family caregivers are doing caregiving duties, tasks, equal to what the paid caregivers are doing with no training. How to give a proper bath, whether it's a bed bath or a standby assist bath, how to properly transfer somebody, how to properly assess health status and vital signs. You need some technical skills to do that, and we need to have a better way of supporting family caregivers, because part of their distress is that they don't know what they're doing, and they're concerned that they're not caring appropriately for their loved one. So what are our recommendations? This report has five specific recommendations. Some of them parrot, actually, recommendations we made 2 years ago. So recommendation number one is to increase access to adult day programs. So just a reminder to everybody, an adult day program is where the client or the loved one will go off for the day. So it will be they'll be out of the house for about 6 hours, give or take, depending on when they're picked up and when they're dropped off back home. And while they're away, they'll be engaging in activities, they'll be given lunch, sometimes it's combined with a weekly bathing program, and then they come back home. So it is a good respite tool for people, but obviously the number of people, the accessibility of that has decreased. So we need to increase. We recommended in the report that an ability to increase capacity very quickly would be through adding evening shifts and weekend shifts. So an adult day program, unlike a facility, doesn't require all the bells and whistles and very, very expensive infrastructure, but you do need a building to have it in, and it's got to have some capacity in it. So there is research that supports evening adult day programs, I guess they're adult evening programs then, are equally efficacious, and in fact, for some groups, more efficacious than a day program. So right now, it centers around come in the morning, we give you breakfast, we start sending people home around 2:30 or 3. We could add a shift that starts coming in around 3:30 or 4, has dinner as their meal, and then goes home around 7:30 or 8. We could also look at pushing out on the weekends a little bit more to see if that would be helpful. We also need to recognize in our adult day programs that everybody is not the same, and so we need to look at the spectrum. There are younger, more physically engaged adults with dementia, and their needs are probably not met through our traditional adult day program, and we need to recognize there are people with profound physical limitations and no cognitive limitations, and they're going to require a different type of adult day program as well. We've recommended increases to home support. We're going to be talking much more about home support later in the year in our home support report. Caregiver support is just one aspect of home support. There's many aspects to it, but the data are the same. Despite our desire to have policies that encourage people to stay at home, the data indicate that we are not putting our money where our mouth is on that particular issue. We are reducing the intensity of home support. When we are only offering an hour a day, we are not providing a substitute for residential care. We have drifted quite significantly from our previous policy of maximizing up to 4 hours a day and supporting people to live at home. We have also recommended that the province be very clear in a policy around home support as respite, that going in the morning and doing the morning care, yes, that's respite for the caregiver from providing those functions, but if you're caring for somebody who cannot be left alone, you need a block of hours to be able to go out of the house, do your banking, do your errands, and come back. That requires probably about a 3 to 4 hour block of respite care. Think about, you cannot leave your home. The person you're caring for cannot be left alone. And the stress to put on you. You have to find people to stay with your mom or dad or your husband or wife while you go out, or you have to pay out of pocket for somebody to do that. So we need to recognize that respite care is as significant and as necessary an allocation of hours as the care hours. So the province needs to say, these are the respite hours a person's entitled to each week and each month, and those are delivered as and when caregivers require them. We've recommended improved access to CECL, the choices for the client direct funding. Clearly, the evidence shows it has a very significant effect on lowering distress, and yet it's a program we don't tell many people about, and we make it very complicated to access. And again, we'll be talking more about the home support program, but in short order, when the case manager comes and does the assessment and presents the options for care, they should be presenting with equal enthusiasm the potential for CECL, and we should make the process for accessing CECL as simple as possible. And we do the opposite at the moment. We need to reorganize respite beds and increase the capacity. So, yes, we have increased accessibility to respite beds in the last 2 years, but we're still not at the level that we should be at. And we've recommended creating units of respite beds, which will improve to a large extent the experience for those who are experiencing respite, and empowering caregivers. So we are recommending that the province engage with provincial partners to find a more formalized way of connecting caregivers to the caregiver supports in their community. So again, making it part of the case management assessment process that we provide information and very specific direct information to family caregivers, and also looking at a consent process at the time of assessment that families would consent for their information to be given to the family caregiver support group in their community to connect with them. Because sometimes what happens in the assessment process is there's a lot going on. There are dozens of pieces of paper and pamphlets and Xerox copies of this and that, and things get forgotten and lost. And so having the ability to give the name of a client direct referral and have that referral reach out to that family 2 or 3 weeks after they've started service to see what support, I think would be a good step forward. So those are our five recommendations. And the full report, which has much more breakdown of the data, can hopefully be found on our website. I'm told we've corrected the glitches. So it will be there for people to download. It's about a 23-page report. It's not onerous to download. But again, anybody who's having any challenges is welcome to call my office. We can walk you through the download or send a copy to you should you wish. So I'm happy now to open it up to any questions.
What do you expect to come out of this report?
Well, similar to what I expected to come out of the last report 2 years ago, I am hoping that health authorities will take this information and it will fan out to the front lines, where we will see an increased emphasis on allocation of home support hours. We will see a recognition of respite and a authorization of those respite hours to families, that we will see a move forward in increasing these adult day program spaces and a reorganization of respite. What's being proposed in this in these recommendations are actions where in 2 years from now we should and will be able to measure the results. These are not actions that take months and years of planning like building new buildings would take. So we would hope to see those things happen. It's possible that we could be seeing increases everywhere and still see increases in distress. That's very true. At least we're trying, and at least we're showing our support. What's disappointing is that we've seen the increase in distress and the decrease in the support. That's what's disappointing over the last 2 years.
In the context of this report, how well do you think the move, the policy shift to keep people in their homes longer is working?
I don't think it's working as well as we think it works by simply proclaiming that that is our policy. Something is falling off or getting lost in the message between the policy level decisions and pronouncements and what's being delivered and authorized on the front line, because they're not the same. If we were genuinely trying to support people at home as much as possible as a diversion to long-term care, we would be seeing an increase in the intensity, not a decrease in the intensity. We could even fathom an argument where you would see a decrease in the number of clients, but a significant increase in the intensity of the clients receiving the service. That would support this. We're not seeing any of that. We're seeing the opposite. And I think the challenging thing is that when you're a family member and you're hearing these messages in the media and from health, you know, we're doing this, and then you have the experience at the coalface with your husband being discharged from the hospital, and you're told you get 1 hour a day of home support, and there's no respite during the first, 6 weeks until we can get out and do an assessment. That's all counter to the message, the policy message. And family members are throwing up their hands and moving people into care facilities. And the evidence supports that we have people in our care facilities who, by virtue of their health assessments, could be cared for at home or in assisted living, and that's not happening. So there's a disconnect between what we say in our policy statements and what we're doing.
So are we looking at a crisis situation because, you know, just going through the report, the population is aging, but it's also because, particularly in parts of BC, I would imagine, like we're aging healthier, so there's complex needs when those needs arise. Like, are you describing a looming crisis? I'm just not getting a sense of the urgency of this. Like, is this urgent, and do we have to get on it, and who's responsible, and, you know, what sort of money should be focused on this?
You'll find I tend to shy away from dramatic proclamations like crises, in part because I've been around a long time. And what happens is the crisis emerges incrementally, not overnight, right? So it's not a big tidal wave. It's not something that's going to breach a dam and all of a sudden the next day everything's flooded. It moves incrementally to that point. So what we're seeing is that an increasing number of the caregivers supporting our home support clients are reporting that they're in distress, which is a big trigger for giving up and placing mom or dad in a care facility. Okay? That's increasing, so it's moving in the wrong direction. The supports to help address that have been reducing, not increasing. So we can be doing more. So what's going to happen is, inch by inch, year by year, we're going to see the numbers rise of people in a care facility that could be cared for at home, right? Or in a assisted living environment, which uses the home support program, right, to provide the care. And so from the government's perspective, they have to ask themselves, we care for, at the end of the day, we do care for people. And we care for them either in the hospital, in a licensed care facility, or at home. And regardless of your income or the money that you bring to the table, we will provide that care for you. We will take some of that money to provide that care, but there's nobody is going to be denied that care. So you have to ask yourself, given that, and given people's preferred preference, most, not all, most people's preferred, 80% on home support want to be where they are, what are the incentives that we should be aligning? Right now, the incentives we're providing push people into residential care. When you look at, I can get 1 hour of home support a day, either for free, or I might have a copay, it is an assessed, or and I pay for everything else, every other additional bit of care, all the food, all the equipment, everything. Or mom can go into a care facility, and I'll pay, the most I'll pay is $3,000 a month. I'll likely pay far less than that because I'm paying based on her income, which is quite low. You can see where we aren't incentivizing. Take out of the equation the humanity of it all, right, which is a big piece of it. But take all the humanity out of the equation and just focus on the economics of it. We are not incentivizing people to do what our policy says we want to accomplish.
I thought it was interesting you said that we're not putting our money where our mouth is. Is that the health regions, the health authorities? Is that the province?
Well, the province allocates money in lump sums with broad policy direction, and its broad policy direction is to support people at home, right? That is, we hear that. That is the broad policy direction. Health authorities get the money. There will always be the issue, is there enough money? What is about solving problems of today versus future problems? I mean, one of the challenges around this issue right now, even though 31% are in distress, you know, getting back to my incremental argument, it's working, right? So we are, yes, the caregivers are crying out for more help, but at the same time, they're doing it. They're taking care of the people while they're complaining, and so it's working for us. So we don't have, because the government's goal, and any government is going to do this, is to fix the most acute problem in the moment and direct the resources there. So that's the argument health authorities will present. But I have to tell you that there is also a culture issue that we like the simplicity of residential care. As a system, when our client moves into residential care as the case manager, my job is done. I don't have to worry about them anymore. They're in a safe environment. Living in the community is living at risk. And some family members have challenges with that, and some healthcare team members have challenges with that, where they see the disaster waiting to happen. They see the fragmentation. They see the phone calls coming. They can never be – it's messy. But the alternative is – putting people where they don't want to be. And people and their families are entitled to determine if they want to live with that uncertainty and sometimes chaos. Some people live in chaos in their 30s and 40s, right? They're accustomed to it. Others don't. So there's an element of that, actually, as well, that we are, when we go in and look at the situation as the healthcare assessor, depending on the lens we view it through, oh, this person has to go into care, this is intolerable, this can't continue, is one lens, same situation. Different lens is, you know what, we can make this a little bit better by just tweaking here, tweaking that. You know, you want to live here, you know, you're at risk. You know, I tell the story about you come in to do the healthcare assessment, and there's the hand-wringing daughter and the 94-year-old dad, and they're saying, you know, Dad, you're going to fall down those stairs and break your hip. You've got to move into the assisted living place. And the case manager's there saying, you know, she's right. You're going to fall. You're going to go to the hospital. You're not eating right. And the dad said, so if I move into the assisted living, I'm not going to die, right? And the answer is, well, no, of course. So people make their choice. And, you know, when people go to residential care, they still die. We're okay with that. But at home, we're not. And so, to get back to so part of it is the allocation of resources, but the other part of it is the culture where we like the safety and certainty of residential care.
Do you have a price tag for these recommendations?
The short answer is no. We know that the province has received some federal monies that they are putting toward home support. We know that the trade-off on 4 hours of home support a day versus residential care is about even, right? That's about the point at which you should be saying, okay, this is what government will do to support you at home. If your support costs exceed this, here's the option we provide you with, which is a care congregate care option, or you can bring additional resources to the table. So we know that 4 hours, interestingly enough, costs of home support have risen, but so have costs of residential care, right? So it's still about, on balance, depending on the health authority, as cost effective, sometimes even more cost effective than care in a facility.
So are people being denied home support because the resources aren't there?
That's what these data would indicate, that, Sarah.
Okay. Yes. Did you hear examples of that? Or?
We have heard examples of that. And there's a couple of stories that we've highlighted in the report. But on the radio several months ago, there was a woman who was talking about her father as an example. And the challenges she was having accessing the home support. And you shouldn't have to go on the radio or to a news reporter to get your home. I mean, 98% of people don't do that and aren't comfortable doing that. And so we know that people are not getting the care that the health assessment of their loved one would indicate they need. We know that by 60% get an hour or less a day, and 52% have Maple 4s and 5s. And we know that we've drifted quite a bit from, I think it was about 5 years ago, we had a big push on Home First. We called it in the capital region. The other health authorities had slightly different names, but the theory was throw the kitchen sink at this person to get them out of the hospital, highly intensive supports for 3 months, and guess what? When we did that, certainly in the capital region here, 50% of the people who were going to go to residential care actually didn't need to go. They could stay at home. They had intense supports for about 3 months. Those supports got dialed back to a maintaining level, and they were able to stay at home and defer it. So, yes, people are finding that they are not able to. There's two issues. I guess there's three issues. They can't access it at all. Issue number one. Probably most significant in rural parts of British Columbia. They can access it, but they don't get the hours that they need. They can get the hours they need, but the way it's delivered and what people will do is so inflexible and frustrating, it doesn't work for them, which I think in part explains the much lower levels of distress on CECL, because those issues go away when you're directing who's going to provide it, when they're going to provide it, how they're going to provide it. It is, but it's like a best-kept secret, Sarah. So what happens is, you know, we'll go in, we'll do an assessment, we'll say you're entitled, you know, you need help with morning care, We'll give you an hour a day, and we might say you get 4 hours of respite, right? We write up the order, and it goes to the home support desk at the health authority. Half of them is health authority employees. The other half is contracted agencies, but there's really no difference in the delivery between those two. And so you get the phone call, you know, we'll do an 8 o'clock visit. What we should be saying is, you know, you get the hour a day. Now, there's two options for you. We can deliver it through the system, and here's what that looks like, or we can give you the client direct funding. And what that means is we'll put money in your bank, in a bank account you'll have to create. We'll put it in every month, and we're going to have to do some checks and balances on that. But you're going to have to hire the person or the agency to do it. We don't let you hire an agency at the moment. That's another inflexibility of the program. It won't work for many people because you have to organize all that. But it will work for some, and the some that it will work for, it will work very well for. And we can't produce, we only can produce anecdotal evidence. I can't produce quantitative evidence on the number of people that with that kind of support in the funding would not send mom and dad to a care facility. They would have kept them at home. Right. So we need to do more to make people aware of it, number one. Number two, we make you wait 6 months. We apparently do another, some health authorities do a separate assessment for CECL. I mean, if you qualify for home support, you qualify for CECL. And the icing on the cake, it's cheaper. So when we fund you for CECL, we'll fund you at $30.39 an hour we give you. And it's on a rate that there's a formula for increases. When we're providing home support, on average in the province, we're paying $44 an hour. So, you know, there's a huge system incentive. So, you know, you look at it, okay, people who use it highly value it, much less caregiver distress, and it's more cost effective for health authorities. We should be doing it. It won't work for everybody, though. And arguably not even the majority. But even if we could move 10 or 15% of people over to CECL, and I think we would see an impact on the distress level.
How often are residents reassessed? I covered a story up in Comox about the elderly gentleman up there that was diagnosed with leukemia in January, and he declined quite rapidly, and then was getting the home support and everything, but he was not able to access hospice beds. He was told there was 57 beds, and he would simply have to wait until someone else passed away, but the list was quite long. How does that tie in with what you're talking about in your report?
That's a slightly different topic. So the topic number one was reassessment of home support of your status. So we are, in theory, supposed to do an annual reassessment. I say in theory because in practice we all know that that does not reliably happen, and we have reports back on that. Or when there's a change in health status. So you can call up and ask the case manager to come in and do a reassessment because you might need more hours, right? Your status has changed. You should be able to get that within a two-week period of time. Depending on where you are in the province, you actually are able to achieve that. The issue of a hospice bed and referral to a hospice bed is a different issue. That would be like a residential care bed. And that's a difficult one because in any system, the excess capacity you would need to be able to guarantee somebody the minute you need it, you get it. It means there's a bed sitting empty, whether it's a care facility or in hospice, is very difficult to predict. And hospice beds are even more difficult to predict. The majority of palliative care, of hospice care, is provided in the community through home support. So again, you would see that through the intensity of home support. So if you were able to get a live-in home support worker for the last 3 weeks of your life, which you can get certainly here in Victoria, but not in all parts of the province, you may not need the hospice bed. But if you can't get that, you need the hospice bed. And even with the 24-hour support in the home, there are people who will prefer the hospice bed, and there are people for whom end-stage pain management does require more nursing care than can be provided in the home. Any questions online?
We do have one question from Gemma Carson-Smith from the Canadian Press. Please go ahead, Gemma.
Hi there. You said that your recommendations parrot what was recommended 2 years ago. Were those previous recommendations not addressed by the government? And if that's the case, what do you want to say to this new government about how to move forward?
Well, the data would indicate they were not addressed because what we hope to see increases in terms of adult day programs, home support, and we did make some progress on Westlake that we didn't see. So to the new government, I think the message would be that remember that almost one in four British Columbians are a caregiver. Not if but when is becoming more the mantra on a caregiver. To be fair, the spectrum of care those people are providing varies. But at the acute end, where they're caring for people on our home support program or the 114,000 other seniors who could be on our home support program, these increasing distress levels are something we need to pay attention to because, as I was saying earlier, this incremental move of people going to they're going to stay in hospital longer. Why? Because they can't go home, because the family member actually needs the break, and so a hospital bed is a very expensive respite provision, or they're moving them into a care facility. Ultimately, maybe the person would have ended up in a care facility, but they're going now 8, 9 months, a year earlier than they need to. You know, very interesting thing. We looked at some data, and our length of stay in residential care may be ticking up a little bit. And that's not something you want to see. You want to see the opposite. Now, it's a little early to categorically say this is an established trend, but we should be seeing length of stay in residential care facilities reducing. You shouldn't be there unless you absolutely need to be there. You should be in assisted living or at home with home supports. So, you know, this is, again, we're going to revisit these numbers again in 2 years. And in part, the reason we are focusing and redoing the reports on caregivers, it's such a significant part of the population of BC. Of the one issue that probably touches the most people from a senior's perspective, it is this issue of caregiving, actually.
So investing in caregiver support now helps to save on other health care costs in the longer term.
That is correct.
Great, thank you.
Any other questions?
We do. The following question is from Briar Stewart from CBC News. Please go ahead, sir.
Yes, At the beginning of the news conference, you mentioned about how BC had some of the highest numbers in the country and how it's right up there with Ontario. What accounts for this? Why are the numbers so high here, and how does it compare nationally?
Our numbers are so high here in part because the frailty and complexity of the clients we care for on home support is higher here to a certain degree. And also, our levels of home support are a little bit lower.
So, and as a follow-up, you mentioned that their numbers are right up there with Ontario. Is that, from your understanding, I guess those would be the two highest regions in the country?
Yeah. And so if you look historically, BC was always very high. And about 3 years ago, Ontario took quite a spike. And when you see that spike, you can link it to a significant increase in the acuity of their people on their home support program. So they took a big leap forward. But we were the highest for quite a number of years and by quite a wide margin. So I'm going by memory here, but I know that if you look at distress, for example, in Alberta, it's less than 20%, and we're at 31%.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
So, sorry, just to clarify, BC is at 31%, which is the highest in the country for caregiver distress.
No, it is one of the highest. So it's BC and Ontario. that are the highest. And Ontario is slightly higher. They've increased as well, actually.
Is there one province that's doing something right that would be?
Well, we know that on a number of fronts. We compare ourselves to Alberta a lot because our overall population size is about the same, although they do have a lower percentage of seniors, but in terms of the overall population. And they, of course, if you talk to Alberta, they see lots of problems too. But on a number of fronts, they do tend to do better than we do. They have much lower for example, in the care facilities, they're better at their use of antipsychotics. They're better at their use of recreational therapy. We know they're better at, they have much lower percentage of people in care facilities that shouldn't be there. And we know that their distress levels are lower. In part, they have a better subsidized assisted living sector in Alberta. We do have that sector in British Columbia, but it's very low. So, you know, order of magnitude, 28,000 subsidized residential care beds, 5,000 subsidized assisted living beds. And a whole bunch of people who could be in assisted living, we put in residential care because we don't have a subsidized assisted living bed for them. Any other questions?
There are no other questions at this point in time.
Well, that's perfect because they're knocking at the door for this room. So you've all been very patient and very kind and in listening to my presentation, and you've been brilliantly on schedule and on time. So thank you very much. Again, everything is posted on the website. And just again, for those of you who are interested, on Friday, September 15th, we will be releasing our results from the residential care survey in the province at an event at the Italian Cultural Center in Vancouver. And we've got some fancy-schmancy way of broadcasting that that's a little bit better than this and hopefully will not experience technical difficulties. So those of you who want to tune in on that, go to the website, call my office if you need any assistance to either attend one of the sessions or figure out how to get on the website. So thank you very much, everybody.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the Office of the Seniors Advocate Conference Call. Thank you for your participation and have a nice day.